President Trump on a Truth Social, said, listen, I want all that nuclear dust immediately. And he never said or what, but he seems to think that he can just get it. And that's not even on the table for the Iranian side. That's like in a phase two. And yet Trump's talking about he wants that prior to phase one. How's that going to work, Doug?
Well, Donald Trump is incoherent. Let's be frank. There is no coherent framework that he sticks to. And he tends to mix various elements of an agreement at different points in time, which explains your, you know, comment about the nuclear dust. The interesting thing is that Rubio sounds, well, ultimately Rubio is more articulate. What he says sounds more plausible, but at the end, it's the same outcome. Either we're going to get what we want or there will be no deal. It's effectively what he's saying. And no deal is better than a bad deal, or so he thinks. What is a bad deal? Anything that leaves Iran intact. And what are the principal stumbling blocks? It's obviously this enriched uranium business that moves back into the center of the discussion routinely. And in addition to that, that Iran cannot retain control of the Strait of Hormuz. Well, those are two insoluble problems from the standpoint of Iran. Iran sees both of those as inextricably intertwined with their national sovereignty and independence. So I think we can say with some certainty there's not going to be a deal. Forget it. The other thing is we aren't talking directly to the Iranians. It seems that people don't really get that, you know, because Donald Trump conveys the impression, well, we're close to a deal and they're much more professional now, as though we have suddenly become professional. I can't conceive of anything less professional than the goons that we've sent over there to negotiate. So at this stage of the game, I think we just have to wait until this war breaks into the open. And I think we're getting closer. And with this event of last night, it seems almost certain that we're going to go back to a hot war.
And let me just kind of underscore that from the Iranian side. We always show what both sides are saying on here, and then we see what's real on the ground. Here, we just saw Rubio say that, well, we have the broad outlines of an agreement. Well, here's what the Iranian side is saying with Foreign Ministry statement spokesman Baghai.
The focus of the negotiations is on ending the war. At this stage, we are not discussing the details of the nuclear issue. Threats, pressures, portrayals, and publishing caricatures are part of the political maneuvering on that side of the world. We pursue our work in the field of action. We see the realities, regardless of the perceptions and imagery of the other side. It is true that we have concluded a large part of the topics under discussion. However, no one can claim that this means an agreement is imminent.
And he went on to say in that same interview, almost exactly what you suggested right there. He said, listen, all we've been doing is sending intermediaries back and forth through Pakistan. But he said, until we are close to an actual deal, we're not even going to meet in person because there's no point in it. So until we see both delegations go into Pakistan, then we might say, okay, now something might actually be possible here. But until that point, Iran's saying we're not even close, even though President Trump is.
No, I think that's true. And, you know, if we could just divert a little bit away from what's really happening in the discussions to what I think are really far more serious issues that the president and his colleagues in Washington don't seem to understand or be facing. You know, in April, U.S. inflation increased from up to 3.8% from 3.2%. Right now, this war is leading to inflation projections for the second quarter of roughly 6%. Now, if that's true, and I think it probably is, that means our interest rates should be at about 7%. But that would be catastrophic for us. And so they're being artificially suppressed and held at about 3.75%. So what are we in really doing right now? We're sort of watching the edifice of our security architecture, our diplomatic strategy, all sort of sink into the abyss. Now, why is this happening? When we first started this war, we ended up taking 13 million barrels of oil off the market every day. If we restart the war against Iran, that is, we go back in and start hammering Iran from the air and from the sea with all the missiles and bombs that we can accumulate. Iran says it will counterattack and remove an estimated 25 million barrels out of the global market. Now, we have 374 million barrels in our strategic petroleum reserve. 25 million barrels are held in Oklahoma, I think in Cushing. The rest tend to be largely in Texas and Louisiana along the borders. Right now, we know that President Trump has sold 17.8 million barrels this last week from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve at a price below market rates. That means lower oil prices below $110 per barrel. Now, what's this done? Well, this has helped him to manipulate the oil market in a way that insulates U.S. users of fuel from the real impact of the Iran war. This manipulation at its current rate will drain our strategic petroleum reserve in roughly 60 days. So let's do the math. That means by the end of July, we're staring at an empty strategic petroleum reserve. Now then let's turn to China. China is 86% self-sufficient in oil, but it still has a 14% shortfall. Those shortfalls are being made up by various countries, including Saudi Arabia, mostly Russia, and some others. So they're not in a dangerous position whatsoever. They've stockpiled oil. They have the largest petroleum reserve in the world, 1.3 billion barrels in above-ground storage. That means they could all be extracted. Now, let's go back and understand what else is happening, because we tend to see the Ukraine war and what's happening there as completely separate and distinct from what's going on in the Persian Gulf. And that's not really true. In 2022, at the start of the Ukraine war, 3 million barrels were taken off the global economy per day. This drove the oil price at that point initially up to $120 per barrel. Today, right now, the United Kingdom and our European allies are providing drone components and targeting data to the Ukrainians so that they can attack refineries and other oil infrastructure inside Russia. This has been successful insofar as it has reduced the numbers of millions of barrels per day by 13 million from the global supply. At this rate, what are the long-term implications? We're going to watch the global economy shrink by an estimated 36%. Now, just for referential purposes, the Great Depression reduced the world economy by 20%. However, the effects of the Great Depression were mitigated by much lower debt to GDP ratios that currently prevail in the United States and Europe. What happens if we lose, say, an estimated 30% of global productivity? Well, this is effectively a global depression. We're going to be part of that. So to talk in a cavalier fashion about, well, we'll go down and bomb these people into the Stone Age. We'll bomb them until they agree to go along with us. And you're staring at 6% inflation projections for the second quarter. I think we're bordering on insanity. This is irresponsible on a scale that I cannot imagine. I don't know of any similar action that any president, king, or emperor in the last 300 years has taken that would compare to the irresponsible approach that we've taken to the Gulf and also towards Russia in the Ukraine war.
Well, which is really saying something, and nobody knows history better than you do. This is literally the first time, I think, since I have known you that you were not able to grab some historical example to say it was kind of like this, which is really scary, because that means that we're navigating something that's never been traversed before, and we have literally the worst people possible at the top to do the navigating. We'll see what that leads.
I don't know if they're the worst, but they're certainly not the right ones. And, you know, I urge people in the audience, you want to understand this, you've got to go to people like Luke Grohman, to Gundlach, Ray Dalio, and Peter Schiff. All of these people are essentially depicting what I just said in even more profound terms. I'm just trying to understand the oil and gas markets. Now, when you start talking about everything else that we're missing, sulfuric acid, without sulfuric acid, yeah, you can't refine anything. that puts the copper industry in a terrible position. You can't refine uranium. I mean, we just go down the list. It's disastrous. And that's just a snapshot. That's the tip of the proverbial iceberg. And at the same time, you know, we're riding here in the United States on something akin to the Titanic that is already partially underwater. That's our economy and the financial system. That's the point. What can we do to get out of this? And frankly, we're not going to escape all the consequences at this point. But if he were to shut down everything right now and simply say, that's it, you know, we cannot go on because this has humanitarian consequences for the entire world. As president of the United States, I am obligated to suspend further combat operations. We're still talking about months before the oil redistribution recovers. And even then, you're looking about 2 or 3 years to rebuild a lot of this infrastructure that's being destroyed. So what we're really talking about, if he goes back to war the way he did before with our forces, is Armageddon. And the idea that the man with his finger on the button for Armageddon is not really Trump, but Bibi Netanyahu, is even more disturbing.
It is. And you know, one of the first ways that we can try to mitigate against some of these economic catastrophe that you're talking about that is in progress until we check that and open it back up is to get the Strait of Hormuz back open up to something close to what it was prior to this war. And that means these dueling blockades that we have, ours against Iran and Iran's with all of the rest of the GCC countries, those things have to be opened. Now, Iran is ready to say the traffic can return to normal as long as they're paying our fees. But Marco Rubio was asked about that last night.
What's happening there is unlawful, it's illegal, it's unsustainable for the world, it's unacceptable. I don't know of any country in the world that does it. The Russians are not in favor of a tolling system. The Chinese are not in favor of a tolling system. And there's no country in the world that's in favor of a tolling system except the regime in Iran. So that's not acceptable. That cannot happen. The straits need to be open, unimpeded, without tolls. And obviously that needs to happen immediately as soon as anything's
agreed. Yeah, obviously that needs to happen. But we tried, Doug, for 40 some odd days to force them to open that straight up, and we utterly failed. And so then we went to this ceasefire that we had to because we realized it wasn't going to work. And so Rubio can say that all day long. But what is going to happen, Doug, to get these two blockades opened up? What's the reality?
Well, the reality is not exactly as depicted by Secretary of State Rubio. Secretary of State Rubio is conveying the impression that somehow or another, miraculously, our views align with the rest of the world, or the rest of the world's views align with us on the subject of the Persian Gulf, and specifically this issue of tolls. Right now, if you look at the polling data that's available, but all you have to do is listen to the leaders and their public statements, the world holds us responsible for shutting down the Gulf. That needs to be understood. They are not blaming Iran for shutting down the Gulf. Everyone understands that it makes sense for Iran strategically to do what it has done. That doesn't mean they like it. Are they opposed to it? Of course. But they blame us for it. This is very important. In India, we've gone from, you know, reasonably popular down to hated beyond belief. And that's not just true in India. The attitude is spreading very rapidly across Asia, particularly in Japan and Korea, in China, all over Asia. This is catastrophic for us. You know, I don't know what to say. You know, the funny thing is I came across this statement by Donald Trump, who made this observation back before he was even elected the first time. And he said, if our presidents would have just gone to the beach and enjoyed the sun and the beach, we would have been much better off in the Middle East. Now stop and think about that. In other words, his attitude was, when he was ultimately became the nominee of the Republican Party in 2016, it was, well, if we had done nothing, Dan, just gone to the beach and enjoyed the ocean and the sun, we'd be much better off in the Middle East today. Well, you know, somebody needs to read that to him again, because that's even more true now than it was then. the damage we did to ourselves and to the world at that point, I wouldn't say it was marginal, but it was recoverable. What we've done to ourselves now in the Persian Gulf, when it was absolutely not necessary to do so, is beyond evaluation. It is global in its impact.
Now, interestingly enough, he left open this, Secretary Rubio, in that last soundbite, he left open that, well, if we don't get the deal we want, implying we would go back in. Now, a lot of people in President Trump's ear have been shouting for that. Of course, you know, the normal ones like Jack Keane, General Kellogg, Mike Pompeo, Mark Levin, Lindsey Graham. These guys have been saying this for a long time. Well, there's a new person here in the last couple of days that's adding to that. And it's your old pal, General Petraeus, is saying, hey, you know what? We might just have to go back and finish this the hard way.
Other core issues that we have with Iran, such as its nuclear stockpile of almost 1,000 pounds of 60% enriched uranium, that's just one level below weapons grade, the right to enrich in the future, their support to proxies in the region that are pretty murderous, the Hamas, Hezbollah, Shia militia in Iraq, Houthis in Yemen, and then the missile programs and the rest of this. And I think it's a pretty limited amount of these other concerns that may ever get addressed, but clearly there has to be an agreement to get this strait reopened and to restore freedom of navigation without, there might be some arrangement where perhaps there is some modest fee charged that might go in part to Iran, Oman, who knows, and navigation aids or something like this. But that, I think, is the imperative at this moment in time. And I'm not sure that Iran is going to be willing to do that. Right now, they are insistent that they are given control of the strait and that they are able to charge tolls for it. That's just, I think, unacceptable. And it may be that we have to go back to war to show them that we're pretty serious about this.
Come on. Help me understand even the logic in his own mind here. You failed to do that when it was full on war for 40 some odd days. Now that we've gotten restocked with the same ammunition against the same targets, and we're going to expect a different outcome. What is in his mind when he said we may have to go back to war to show them we're serious?
Well, let's reflect for a minute on what David Petraeus thinks is war. To him, war at this point is simply high-altitude bombing, and missile strikes from the sea, from the air. That's all. He doesn't seem to understand what he's actually describing. This is not Iraq. This is not Afghanistan. This is Iran. This is a huge country. It has a real civilization. It's a real nation state. It's not a collection of Arab tribes that were herded together as a result of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. This is not in any way, shape, or form artificial. This is real. He's talking about going to war. If you're going to go to war with Iran, you're going to have to mobilize the United States. This is not a minor affair. People forget that Germany in 1942 had roughly 80 million people. We're talking about an Iranian population of 93 million right now. And they obviously have access to extraordinarily advanced technology in a whole range of areas, as well as to overhead satellite arrays in space. And he's talking in a cavalier way about, well, I guess we'll just have to go to war to make our point. Now, I'm sure the people that have him on their payroll at KKR, all of whom are ardent Zionists and part of the larger Israeli-Jewish financial network, will reward him for his statements. But this is extremely irresponsible. The United States has no interest whatsoever that would justify this kind of action. None. And at the same time, we ought to step back and keep in mind that we have this state called North Korea, which everyone insists is ruled by a madman. I've never subscribed to that. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's quite sober-minded, actually. But a lot of people think, oh, well, he's just a dangerous maniac. And he has nuclear weapons. What are we doing about it? Nothing. Why are we doing nothing? Because he has nuclear weapons. So what is David Petraeus and everybody else on the neocon globalist Israeli agenda part of? They're part of a group of people that are convincing billions of people all over the world to invest heavily in nuclear weapons to ensure that we and our Israeli friends never try to interrupt or disrupt or invade them.
And of course, that's not going to lead anywhere. That's not going to get the strait open. It's not going to help the problem here. It's just going to exacerbate it. And the Iranian side has said, yeah, if you do that, we're going to do all these other things, and you're not going to destroy our mountains. You're not going to destroy our missile bases. So I just can't even understand, even within the twisted logic of the, you know, the neocons and all that kind of stuff, they have to be able to see, and this is more a question than a statement, they have to be able to see, don't they, that it physically can't work, so that their desired objective, regardless of what it is, can't be accomplished. And if they try, it's going to harm us, right? I mean, don't they see that?
My real question is, if Donald Trump 10 years ago could tell the New York Times, if our presidents had only just gone to the beach and enjoyed the ocean and the sun, we'd have been better off in the Middle East. What happened? What's wrong with Donald Trump? That was an eminently reasonable and balanced statement by Donald Trump, because the first law in foreign policy and diplomacy is do no harm. In other words, if you can avoid going in somewhere with military power, it's in your interest to do so. We have no reason to do any of the things that Petraeus argued for. So what are we doing? What is Donald Trump doing? Where is this man? What has happened to him? I mean, I guess that's the $60,000 question that I ask myself almost every day.